Hey, hey, hey. Welcome, everyone, to the Musician's Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Mark, and I'm super duper stoked to say that today I will be talking with singer-songwriter Paul McCoy from the band 12 Stones. In addition to all of 12 Stones' singles, many of you may know of Paul from his guest appearance in the Evanescence track Bring Me to Life, which we talk about in this interview. We also talk about band life and just coming up in a band, how to be in a band, all the usual stuff. I'd like to thank Paul for his time, and I'd like to thank each and every one of you for taking the time to listen to this interview. Please do me a favor, leave us a rating or review on your preferred streaming platform. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Paul McCoy. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am super, super stoked today to say that we have the one and only Mr. Paul McCoy from 12 Stones on the podcast. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing wonderful, man. I'm happy to be here with you today, and I appreciate you giving me this time.
No problem at all. We're going to jump straight into it. I always do this really strange thing in the beginning of each episode. You know, obviously, come post-production, I will include an introduction as to who you are for those listeners that might not know. I mean, they've probably been living under a rock if they don't know. But what I always do with all my guests, as weird as it is I ask you to introduce yourself. Tell our listeners who Paul McCoy is so that they get a better idea of where you're coming from during the course of this interview.
Sure. I sing for the band 12 Stones. I've formed in 2001. We're based out of Louisiana here. And I also sang on Evanescence's hit song, Bring Me to Life. In 2002, I believe it was. So that's probably where most people will know me from. Most people think I was in that band until they find out it was just a feature. So yeah, that's a little bit about me.
Amazing. We're going to talk about that song, obviously, and I'm sure you're probably sick of talking about that song at this point in your career. But, I mean, it was massive, absolutely massive, still is. I mean, you it's not very often you can turn on alternative rock radio and not hear that song, shall we say. But we'll kind of build up to that. So tell us a little bit about what drew you to music. I mean, I did a bit of research. I saw that you grew up for the first few years in Illinois before moving to Slidell and eventually Mandeville. Briefly, you told me before we hit record that you were living in Nashville before you moved back to Louisiana. So, you know, what drew you to music? And, you know, just it's been such a wild ride for you. So coming back to Mandeville, family and friends, tell us a little bit about all of that.
Sure. Yeah. Music was something that my mom sang in the choir when I was growing up. You know, I've always been drawn to the idea of music. I've always loved the creative side of it. And so when I was young, I got a guitar when I was probably 13 or 14 for Christmas one year. And I blew my amp up the first day, just turning it to 11. And I've been hooked ever since. You know, I've always just been a huge fan of music. And I remember sitting in Spanish class in seventh grade and hearing the Frog Stomp album by the band Silverchair. And I did a little research and realized that they were the same age. And I was sitting in Spanish class and they were writing albums. And I said, you know what? That's what I want to do. I don't want to be sitting in class. I want to be writing rock music. So it got me motivated to hear, you know, 15-year-old, 14-year-old kids making records. And I was like, man, all right, so it can be done. And then within a few years, I worked really hard, and we got our first record deal when I was 19. So only a few years behind, but we worked hard to get there. So
yeah, and I want to talk about that as well, because so again, upon doing my research, you guys were signed just 15 months after you graduated. I mean, that is crazy. That is crazy. Tell us a little bit about what led to that, the work you had done. You know, were there any sort of, I hate to use the word, like, you know, loopholes that you kind of skipped past, or you know, most bands have to do groundwork for years. I mean, you guys were teenagers. Were you able to do the typical let's go gig until we build up an audience so that led you to that? Or how did that come about?
To be completely honest, we were very, very lucky. We were in the right place at the right time. When we set out, we didn't plan on doing anything. Honestly, it was just none of us were friends before we started the band. We all met at a music store here in Louisiana. And this was like, oh, you play drums? That's cool. I play guitar. Oh, you play bass? That's cool, man. Come check this out. And we just kind of started meeting at this music store more and more often. And we only created a band name so that we had something to go by. We played a couple shows opening up for some really good local bands, a band called Groundfault, and a few others that were just like crucial to us playing. We got to go open for them. And then I think we only played 12 or 13 shows as a band before we had interest from labels. And it was a very, we took our demo in to a radio station to try to get on a festival they were doing for local bands. And the DJ was feeling, I guess, bored that night. And he let us in the studio and he was interviewing us and just kind of like, I think, killing time. And then he heard the songs and was actually impressed and contacted the guy that ran the radio station and asked if he could play our music on the radio. And he said yes. And then we were driving back home and got to hear ourselves on the radio the very first night. And it's been just a whirlwind experience since then. So we were very lucky. You know, there was no, we didn't have any friends or any hookups or any connections. We just, to be completely honest, got lucky. We ended up at the right radio station, the right night with the right DJ. And, you know, the names got passed along and we were very, very fortunate to start a career.
It's incredible. I mean, I talk to so many people on this podcast about just the power of, you know, dreaming and manifestation and trying to chase your goals. And going back to you earlier saying that, like, you discovered Silverchair, realized they were like 14, 15 with Frog Stomp, decided that's what you want to do. Not even 4 or 5 years later, you're pretty much following the same path. It's pretty crazy to me. I find it so inspiring, these kinds of stories. Talk to me a little bit about the fact that, so you start this band with ideally strangers that you meet in a music store. That to me is fascinating too, because what was the chemistry like? Were you guys just all super excited that you could at least play with other people so that the chemistry felt good? What was the writing process like in that sort of dynamic? That's just, again, it's such an interesting concept. You know, most people who start bands will typically start a band with somebody they know, or a friend of a friend plays a guitar, or a cousin down the road had a drum set, you know, something like that. So the fact that you guys are strangers, it's so unique.
Yeah, it's so wild. Like, I feel like you couldn't write this for a movie script if you tried. It's one of those things where it was the local music shop right around the corner. So I would always go in there and just daydream about the equipment I could never own because I didn't have any money growing up, you know? So I would just go play on these expensive guitars I couldn't afford. And, you know, two of the guys that worked there, one was Eric, our lead guitar player, and another one was named Pat Quave, and he was our original drummer prior to the record deal stuff. And they both worked there. And so I would go in there and I basically annoy them with all my questions and, you know, playing on all the instruments. And then one day Kevin Darr, our bass player, walked in asking for bass strings and we were like, oh, that's cool. You play bass. So I went in there as like, singer, songwriter, guitar, rhythm guitar guy. Eric was a blues, you know, Pat was a great drummer. And then Kevin came in with this crazy Les Claypool, and slap and thump and vibe, and we all have completely different musical backgrounds, so we were able to really come in. I would come in with a rhythm guitar idea and like a little bit of a vocal melody, and I would just start playing it, and then one of the other guys would sit down next to me and, you know, add to it. And then we just started saying, hey, like, let's meet up here tomorrow and see what happens. And then, you know, the owner of the music store let us come in there and jam after the store was closed. And so we had access to all the stuff in the space, and we just take all these little ideas that I had, and we would run with it. And I think one of the first songs we wrote was The Way I Feel, which is the song that got us our record deal only a handful of months later. So it's definitely, we understand how lucky we are to be in the position that we were for the last 20 years. You know, there's a handful of moments that I can say that were directly responsible for us even being on this interview right now. You know, with a wonderful lady, Diana Meltzer. She was the co-owner of Wind Up Records. The first band she ever signed in her career was a little band called Creed. Then she went on to sign Evanescence, Seether, Finger 11, some of these just bands that were crucial. And she loved us. She heard the way I feel, and she said, we have to sign them. The rest of the record label wasn't so interested. And she said, well, y'all don't pay the bills, so I'm staying, we're signing them. And so without her, we wouldn't be anywhere either. So again, there's a very small amount of situations that happened that we couldn't have been scripted any better that got us to the position we're at today.
Amazing. I mean, obviously at the time, Wind Up Records were arguably the biggest label in the world. I know that you guys eventually left the label. What was the decision behind leaving the label? And a sort of double-barreled question, in today's musical climates, how important do you feel having a label is for a band?
Well, when we were with Wind Up, we were very fortunate. You know, we were in good company. Like I said, we had a lot of great bands on that label. But along with being in such great company comes the fact that we were not a priority to the label as a whole. And that's okay, because we understand, you know, every time we would try to release a single, Seether would release a single. And, you know, at that time, radio was only willing to play 3 to 5 current radio singles mixed in. And, you know, we're always competing with bands that have a bigger following than us. We were always the band that was opening the big arena shows. So we kind of knew where we fit in the world of Wind Up. And, you know, as things went on, unfortunately, Alan Meltzer, the owner, passed away. There was some regime changes along the way. And we just felt that for us and Wind Up, our relationship had kind of run its course. And, you know, we were kind of looking more just doing something different with our lives. But then, you know, the universe had other plans, and we signed another record deal and then did an album on that. And then that went away. That record label folded. And then we signed a third record deal, did one album with them. Then that just kind of fizzled. And now we're fully independent. And we just did our last EP as completely independent artists. So I, to answer the second part of that, I do believe that, you know, it's better for the artist to have the push and the help from a label, from a financial standpoint, to get the tool support, to get on the road. But with modern technology and the way the world works these days, I you know, if a band can promote themselves properly and a band can financially get themselves established, then I think record labels are a thing that aren't as needed as they once were, especially considering how much they plan to take from the artist. You know, if we're talking about percentages of merchandise sales and all, you know, percentage of touring, you know, they don't ever have to leave the house. They don't have to do anything, whereas the bands are crammed into vans playing Tuesday night shows at 6 p.m. for 5 people, you know, basically begging for somebody to buy a t-shirt so they get gas to the next place. It's hard for bands to be able to sustain themselves in that type of financial climate. You know, whereas if you have a good financial banker or someone that understands how things work, then yes, a partnership and a label does have its upsides, but it seems to be less and less as technology progresses.
Yeah, very true. Very true. You know, I want to just ask about the independent thing before I go to my next question. So now that you guys are fully independent, are you in a position whereby every band member maybe has some kind of home studio set up and you guys are even tracking and recording in that manner? Or are you guys still going to a studio to bang it out, like, you know, as a record, everybody in the same kind of live room tracking an album? What's your process in that regard?
Well, these days we're all kind of spread out. Some of the guys live in different states and we're kind of spread out. We each have our own little areas. for getting ideas down. I'm not well versed. I'm not qualified to run the equipment I do have. I can get the basics done, but for the most part, I submit a lot of the writing ideas, and we're very fortunate enough to have the friendship and partnership that we do with producer Skid Mills. He's worked with us from the Anthem for the Underdog record, Beneath the Scars. He just did the last EP with us. And when I was living in Nashville, that's where he's at. And we were able to take some ideas that we had. The guys can record their parts individually. And then I would go to Skid's studio and we would do all the finalizing work and the vocals and the mixing and all that. So we're fortunate enough to have a great friend in Skid Mills that understands, you know, the chaos that the music industry is most of the time. And so we just are able to go partner with him and get the work done. So,
yeah. And, you know, I think it's just great. I mean, the records still sound great and current, and there's really no critique you can give on the sonic side of things. So that's excellent. Just a side question here, which wasn't part of my questions, but I want to kind of just segue here from your answers. So when you were living in Nashville, did you attempt to do like the co-writing thing and become like a writer out there based on the fact that you already had a name as an artist yourself, or were you still predominantly focusing on 12 Stones?
To be completely honest, I've always thought about the co-writing thing. I did a bunch of co-writes for 12 Stones years and years ago. And it just felt forced to me in a lot of aspects. Like, I got to write with some amazing songwriters, but it felt like it was a cram session, if you will. So for one instance, when we were still on Wind Up Records, I was maybe after the second album, Wind Up wanted me to possibly do some solo stuff, which I wasn't into. But they had me go to Los Angeles for 2 weeks. And while I was out there in 2 weeks, I think I did 8 to 10 different writing sessions. So I would basically go meet a writer or a group of writers, introduce myself, listen to some ideas, show them some of my ideas. And by that afternoon, we needed to be tracking. Wow. And then the second day was the finish up work. And then on day three, it was meeting the next group or the next writer. So it took away the natural feel and the organic thing that I've always grown to love about the writing process to me. So I've done some feature work with some other artists where if they have something written, I could jump on and sing on it. Or if they want to have me co-write with them, then, you know, we take it to that level. But I'd much rather the organic process than the go in there with somebody. As talented as they are, it's hard to go in with somebody, say, "Hey, how you doing? My name's Paul. You know, here's a little bit of my backstory. Let's be recording a new hit song this afternoon," you know, no preface. So when I was in Nashville, I kind of had resigned to the fact that maybe we weren't going to do much more with 12 Stones. You know, we were all kind of living all over the place. We all have, significant others and kids that aren't so much kids anymore. My daughter just started college. So, you know, we're kind of growing out of the realm that we were in for so long. So I started focusing more on myself and just trying to figure out where I was going in life. And then this last EP happened where we just had some songs, and luckily I was around Skid, and him and I talked and decided to put some more music out. So
that's awesome. Okay, let's get to the questions you've probably been asked a bazillion times.
No worries.
You get signed. You do the guest appearance on "Bring Me to Life," the Evanescence tune. Song goes massive, wins a Grammy, sells like over 1 million copies. I mean, just massive. I mean, I can't overstate how huge this song is. You will know you were part of it, but to anybody listening who's never, or at least thinks they've never heard the song, I guarantee you've heard it. It's one of those staples on rock radio, if you still listen to rock radio. If you don't, it'll be on some sort of rock playlist at least. So I want to kind of ask a few different things here.
Sure.
First one might be a little bit tough to talk about. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. So if you don't want to talk about it, that's okay. But I read that apparently Amy Lee from Evanescence was dead set against the idea of having the rap in that song when they first pitched it. Now, I don't know if that's true. I've never gotten to speak to her about it. I did meet her a few years back, but I didn't, you know, didn't straight out the bat go, hey, is this true? That just seems like a weird approach. But, you know, obviously the rap plays a massive part in the song, whether she wanted it or not. And if you look at clips that come up of Evanescence nowadays, you know, someone's still always guesting on that rap. I've seen Sunny from POD do it. I've seen Jacoby from Papa Roach do it. I've seen so many guys do it. So, you know, was that ever expressed to you before you tracked it? That's my first question. And then my second question, which I'll, I'm happy to repeat it later on, but I'll mention it now anyway, is what was your overall experience during the situation, especially if it was known that maybe, hey, we don't really want this part in the song? I mean, because that's got to make you feel a little uncomfortable, I would imagine.
Sure. So for me, I was not aware of any of that prior to recording. And I only found out that they didn't want me on the song when we were in Romania shooting the music video.
Oh, wow.
So I was on the other side of the world when it first registered to me that I was more excited about this than anyone else, you know? So the way it went was this, you know, the record label wanted that. That was what was popular at the time. 2001, 2002, rap rock was it. New metal, rap rock.
I mean,
we're talking Linkin Park. We're talking Saliva. We're talking Papa Roach. And that was the thing. That was what was popular. I didn't realize that the record label was pushing that part. So when we went to a meeting for 12 Stones in New York at Wind Up Records, and we were sitting in the president at the time, Steve Lerner, we were sitting in his office, and he was like, let me show you guys this new song from this new band we signed, and let us know your thoughts. And they showed us, and they had one random producer just kind of like mumbling the words of that part. And they said, we're trying to get so-and-so, we want to get this person, we want to get that person. And they were going after some big names. They were going after the people that were popular at the time. And I jokingly said, well, hey, man, you know, if you can't find anybody famous to do it, I'll do it. And it was kind of a joke. Y'all laughed at it. No big deal. And then a few weeks later, I got a phone call from the record label, and they said, hey, were you serious? Would you be interested in doing the featured vocal on their song? And I said, yeah, man, you know, I love watching the creative process because it's different for everybody. The way I write a song is different than someone else. So, you know, I just finished, I think we were between the first and second record at this time. And I was like, yeah, I would love to be featured on someone else's record. So the record label's coming to me saying, you're the one, we decided you're it. So we were getting ready to leave for a tour with Seven Dust, and they said, take your stuff off the bus, go to the airport. We're flying you to LA. You're gonna go to the studio, track the song, and then we'll have you back on tour tomorrow. I flew to Los Angeles. I tracked the song. The band was in the studio. They were super, super nice to me. I never got any feeling that I wasn't welcome or anything. I went in. Dave Fortman, who's a big fan, a big friend of the band, he did our first demo. He's the reason we got a record deal. He's a lot of it. He was producing that record. So I spent a lot of time with Dave because I knew him. I didn't really know the rest of the band. So I went in, I did my part. I was there for a couple hours, caught a red-eye flight back to Texas to join the tour. And, you know, I was none the wiser. And it wasn't until, like I said, we were in Romania shooting the video that someone asked me how I was liking the experience. And I said, you know, this is amazing. I said, I can't imagine how it must feel to do this type of thing with my own band. You know, I said, this is an amazing, I'm so honored to be a part of this, you know, but it's like, you guys like all know each other. So I kind of feel a little like the experience might be a little different if I was doing this with my own band. And comments were made about how, you know, I should be so fortunate to be, you know, basically that they didn't, I wasn't part of it initially. And then I should be grateful that I was given the opportunity. And I was like, oh no, I am. I'm definitely appreciative. And then from that moment on, I started hearing the grumblings and the underlying thing. You know, they felt as a band that their creative integrity was being encroached upon. I somehow got roped into the side of the villain with the record label. And again, I had no idea that the band themselves didn't write this part, that they didn't want this part on the record, that they didn't. I just assumed that they wrote the song. They were looking for somebody. Nobody took the gig, so I got it. And then years later, I start reading all these interviews and all these things about how, you know, and then, you know, how I encroached on their creative vision. And I'm like, whoa, man, like, I was invited here, maybe not by you, but I didn't know that. And if I ever felt like I stepped on someone's toes creatively, I never would have done that. That's not the type of person I am. You know, I thought I added to it. I thought that I did the part. Again, I didn't write the part. I just showed up and performed what was written for me. So none of this registered until after the fact. I'll be honest with you. I have no idea.
Was it somebody in the camp, or was it one of the producer kind of people?
If I had to guess, I would say it was probably a producer outside of the band. But again, I don't know. I showed up and the part was written, and I was told, this is where you sing, this is what you sing, do your best. And that's what I thought was happening. And so, you know, I got my feelings hurt for several years there when I felt like I was like being hated on for no reason. You know what I mean? Like I thought I did a good job at the job that I was given. So we toured with Evanescence for a couple of weeks, right after the song had just taken off. And I wasn't even allowed to do that part live with them. We were on tour with them.
That's so strange. I mean, you would think, given that the song did blow up like that, if you're on tour together, right. It's a bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, there was some weird tension for a while, but I was never angry at the band. I totally respect them for wanting to retain their creative integrity, you know?
Yeah.
As songwriters, I can totally get, you don't want somebody from the outside coming in and telling you, well, this song isn't as good as it should be because you don't have some other person doing something for you. So, again, had I known the feelings and the vibes that were happening prior to me doing the song, my life probably much different now, but I would have said, oh man, all right, well, definitely.
Of course.
If you're not feeling it, you know, no harm, no foul. You know, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. You know, I'm very fortunate, and obviously in hindsight, I'm very fortunate to have my name attached to such a massive song. But my intention was never to take anything away from them and what they created. I mean, that's 100% them. They did all the work. They did all the writing. They're a phenomenal band. They're great people. So, you know, again, it's strange how it played out. You know, that just goes back to show you how record labels operate.
Yeah.
Because I was in the dark, you know, and I thought that Evanescence had voted me over some of these other big name guys. And that was not the case at all. I think because Evanescence was so new, all the other guys that had the big names and the notoriety didn't want to attach their name to something that was not proven. They didn't want to say, I'm going to go sing with this female fronted rock, you know, type of music without them having been tested or proven or anything. Now, in hindsight, I've heard a lot of these people say they turned it down or, you know, the schedules didn't line up or something. And I'm like, don't do that. You know, don't claim it now. Like, you turned it down for whatever reason, you didn't get the gig, but don't make it sound like I just got the scraps. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And that's kind of some where my frustration comes in. It was like, I see the interviews and I read the articles, you know, and the thing is people tag me in this stuff constantly. So it's not like I don't see it. I see every interview that someone's done that says, yeah, you know, I was going to do it, but, you know, it was not my thing. It was like, well, that's not what happened. You know, it just makes me feel like I'm just the little kid that got the leftover scraps because you were too busy to be on it. And now that the song has been a huge success, now you want to attach your name to it somehow.
Yeah.
When you passed, right? So you didn't do it. And now you're trying to take it from me, even 20 years later, when I'm the one that had to sit here and get told that I ruined a song or I was encroaching on it. And it's gotten to the point where it's even been debated online where I inject myself into these debates because I think it's funny to see people argue with me on how things happened without knowing that I'm the one that it happened to. It kind of makes me laugh, honestly. But I see people talking about how, you know, because she's a female, that my masculinity wouldn't let me just let her have her thing. And I'm like, I was invited, you know, I wasn't trying to male, female is out the window. I wasn't trying to hurt anyone. I wasn't trying to take away anyone's artistic abilities or freedoms. Like I was invited, you know, maybe not by you, but again, if I'm in the dark, am I to blame? And then the song blew up and was successful. So how much damage did I do to their career or to that song?
You know, I think, and again, I was not there, so I don't really have much jurisdiction here, but I wouldn't be surprised hearing your story if, as much as you were left in the dark, they were probably left in the dark too. And somewhere along the line, some things weren't communicated correctly with either party. And then, you know, fast forward with forums and chat rooms and all these things. And people are so quick to, you know, put fuel on a small fire that these things can sometimes blow out of proportion, you know. Look, the bottom line is this. This song was massive, still is massive. You're a part of it. They're a part of it. And whether they like it or you like it, it's going to be etched in people's memories in even some kind of nostalgia kind of factor, because a lot of people grew up with that song just playing constantly. So
sure.
I think you did a great job. I think they did a great job. I don't know all the ins and outs with everybody, but the bottom line is it's a great song and it works. So that's just my opinion on it, you know?
Yeah, you know, I'm very, very appreciative. Again, in my entire career, I've been right place, right time. Sometimes it hasn't felt like the right place, but, you know, I have nothing but love and respect for Amy and the entire band. I don't have any ill will. I'm not upset about the way they feel about the song. I understand it. You know, if anyone understands it, it should be another artist. So, you know, I regret the way it happened, but again, I think it turned out okay. It was the 13th highest selling album from 2000 to 2010, behind the Beatles number one and like the Michael Jackson greatest hits, or a couple of. I think that they did okay with it. You know, I definitely don't think I sunk the record for them by being a part of it. So you know what I mean. I don't have any ill will. I got nothing but love for them, and I'm eternally grateful that I did get the opportunity, whether of their choosing or not. I'm forever grateful that I got the opportunity to be on such a massive song. And it definitely helped, you know, get more notoriety for 12 Stones along the way. You know, we were able to include that. I got to go on the Jay Leno show. I won a Grammy. I got to do things that I wasn't able to do with my own band. So, you know, forever grateful.
Yeah. Incredible. Okay, I've asked other guests this question before. I'm going to ask you as well, just because I feel like you've got experience with it. I mean, 12 Stones has been going since around the early 2000s. You're still going. That in itself is a massive success. I mean, longevity in this business is hard, as I'm sure you know. Talk to me a little bit about sort of mindsets and positivity, especially when it comes to revolving band members. You know, I mean, I know you've had two or three of your guys who are currently with you. They've been there for a few years, but obviously in the course of the 23 years, there's been a fair share of members in your band. That's normal. Anybody who's ever been in a creative situation will know. I mean, it's funny that people can leave day jobs and no one ever says anything, but people leave a band and the whole world always wants to just keep on about it. But I want to know more from your side personally. How do you stay positive in situations where it feels like, you know, it's one step forward, two steps back? Band member comes in, band member leaves. Whether that's through their choice or yours, how do you keep that momentum up when you feel like sometimes you're being let down?
You know, for me, I've always believed in the songs, you know. I've always believed in the music. And when we've had band members change, it's always been for a legitimate reason. Either they had different goals in life than they were on from the trajectory they were currently on, or, you know, we just, it wasn't a good fit. But it was never just like we were left hanging or we just left someone hanging. Like, you know, we have had almost a significant revolving door guys that have kind of come and gone, but I've got nothing but love for any of them. You know, they came in, everyone always put in their best effort. You know, but as we've gotten older, we realize that life outside of this band is much more important to a lot of people. You know, for people like myself and Eric, who have been here from day one, this is what we bleed. You know, we eat, sleep, and breathe these songs and this music. It's who we are to the current day. But for a lot of guys that have come in, we've had a lot of guys that were touring guys that didn't necessarily get to express their creativity through the writing process. You know, we had them come on tour with us. We paid them. They came and played the parts and they did their job and they did a great job while they were a part of it. Some wanted more creative hands in the creative process than we were willing to give up. And some just decided that after touring for a while that maybe that wasn't the best thing for their lives. So, you know, I got no ill will towards anyone that's ever been a part of the process with us, nothing but love. But to stay positive is just to say, hey, we believe in these songs. We believe in the power of music as a whole. And, you know, when we go to shows and, you know, fans come up to us and say how much our songs mean to them, and, you know, that's what keeps us pushing. You know, hey, you know, it's bigger than us. It's bigger than the individual members that come and go within this band. The songs have to be priority, and that's kind of how we keep pushing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I know we briefly touched on it a couple minutes back, but we've kind of like gone back and forth on it now. Nowadays, what's your writing process like? How does it work for you creatively? Do you take just ideas to the producer you mentioned and then you guys sort of shove it out? Or do you go with a full-fledged finish idea to the band and then produce it up?
For me, I've always been where I traditionally write with an acoustic guitar, and I will write a rhythm guitar part that I like, and then I'll put it down myself, maybe on my phone, and then just come up with melodies on top of it. And usually when I get something that I feel like might have potential, I'll send it out to the band guys and say, hey, what do you think about this? And Eric and I have worked together for so long, and he's such a far superior guitar player beyond me that I can show him an idea and he says, all right, I know what you're trying to do. I know what you want to do right there. And then he does what I'm thinking. And so then I get that back and we were able to bounce ideas off of each other. But traditionally it comes with me just kind of writing an idea, just bits and pieces. And then I send it out to the guys. And then from there, you know, we kind of send it back and forth. And by the time we get most of it done, then we can take it to Fresh Ears with Skid or, you know, our previous guitar player, Justin Reimer, also another phenomenal producer. I send him a lot of ideas and we go back and forth until we kind of feel like, all right, we're onto something here. And then we can tighten it up.
And what about lyrically? Do you typically, are you one of the like pick up a guitar and the lyrics come out with your melody at the same time kind of guys? Or are you more you scatting a melody and then maybe thinking about your topic or your subject matter afterwards and then writing your lyrics?
I try to let it happen organically. Sometimes the songs write themselves. They're like, for instance, for Anthem for the Underdog, I had the music for that. And when we were in a rehearsal room, I took the music to the band and said, hey, those are the guitar parts. Everyone started playing it, and then I just started singing, and the words were just there. It just kind of wrote itself. And then there's other times where, like, I'll write a guitar part, and I'll hear a melody, and I start thinking, like, hey, you know, this makes me feel kind of sad. Maybe this has a sad vibe to it. And then I'll hear maybe, like, one melody line that a word pops out, and then I'm like, okay, that goes. And then from that point, then I can kind of, you know, have that skeleton, and I'll construct around it just from the basic feel that the music gives me. I really try to let the feeling of the song at its root dictate where we go.
Nice.
Lyrically and beyond.
Yeah, that's cool. We briefly touched on, you know, the music industry and how tough it can be. When you've been doing this as long as you have, what do you think has been the hardest part about choosing this as a career path for you?
The inconsistency. My brain needs structure. I'm ADD. I'm hyper-focused constantly until I'm not. I'm a million miles an hour or nothing. So for me, it's always been the inconsistencies, not only financially, but just not knowing where I'm going to be a week from now, not knowing where I'm going to be a month from now, whether I'm going to be on tour or whether I'm going to be in a studio, whether I'm not going to be doing anything and I need to get a temporary job to hold me over. Now, these days, we don't really tour anymore. We still do writing and things like that. But as we've grown, now we have consistent jobs. You know, we all have jobs and things we do outside of the band that take priority. But that was always the hardest part for me is, you know, missing out on birthdays. You know, my daughter, I missed out on a lot of her young life because I was chasing the dream, as it were, and I'm trying to build up, you know, the career that therefore to keep the lights on at home. So we make a lot of sacrifices that most people don't realize. You know, when you're gone 8 months out of the year, you miss a lot. And you never know where the next paycheck's coming from. You never know if the song's going to be good, if a tour's going to be good, if you're going to have, you know, issues with personnel. And so that, you know, now as being older, it's nice to have a job that you can rely on a consistent paycheck and a schedule versus being a 22-year-old kid waking up at a truck stop in the middle of the Midwest going, what state are we in? You know, where are we going? What are we doing? Like, I always loved the travel aspect, but just the not knowing is hard for someone like me to process for 15 straight years.
Yeah. And also if you kind of go back in time to those kind of, you know, 2000 to 2010, I suppose, as far as that, it's not like the technology was as advanced as it is now. You know, we didn't have FaceTime, and I think we might have had Skype, but like even to get internet while you were out on the road was tough enough.
Yeah, we had to have the little hotspots that you had to pay like a monthly cell phone bill through AT&T. It was not good.
Yeah.
And it only worked in certain spots. And, you know, when I'm up and going, like if we're doing a show and we play, and we don't get done hanging out and interacting with the fans until after midnight, you know, then it's hard for me to try to Skype and see my sleeping daughter if that's the case. And when I'm sleeping during the day, she's up and doing her thing. So it was trying to force the timing and make things happen. It's just quite a whirlwind. And, you know, I don't even have very many videos from our prime because cell phone videos weren't really that much of a thing back in the day in the beginning, you know, so people weren't bringing their on the shoulder handy cams to come to shows. So, you know, I try to go back and watch video footage from our heyday touring with the big bands and doing stuff. And it's almost impossible to find any of that.
Wow. You mentioned earlier that your daughter is about to start college. Is she musical at all?
She can sing. She won't tell anybody that, but she is a writer. So she wants to go to school for creative writing. And she is going to Stephen F. Austin. So she's going to a creative college, and I could not be happier for her to get out and find her own voice and find her own path in life, you know. So she's just such a great kid. And, you know, obviously she's got her own goals and aspirations, and I'm 100% in support.
Yeah, man, as you should be. Paul, if you were to do it all again and you could do it with the knowledge and experience you have now, but you wanted to launch a band now, what do you think your approach would be?
Save all the money. You know, we were one of the bands that got one of the last of the big signing advances, the signing bonuses. I was a 19-year-old kid, and I was given a lot of money, and I just thought that was the beginning, and that was not right. You know, I would definitely be smarter with my financial decisions, and I would also realize that Rome wasn't built in a day. We don't have to do it all right now. We could, you know, enjoy the moments a little bit longer than we did, you know, whereas we're like, all right, we've got to do another record. We've got to do another one now, another one now. We have to do this. We really didn't get to enjoy everything because we were just forced into the machine pretty quickly. So probably slow it down and save some dollars.
Very good advice. And on that note, Paul, I have one last question for you. It's a bit of a heavy hitter. It always seems to make people go, so take your time if you need to. Some people just have one in the barrel. But what do you think, either through outside sources or through you discovering it yourself, what do you think has been the best piece of advice you've ever received in relation to your music career?
To be honest with you, I learned on my own very early how to treat people. You know, being a fan first, I when I started touring, I was a kid. I was 19, and I met some people that were just like the biggest rock stars in the world as I was a kid, and they treated me as an equal. And then I met other people that were just rude and just mean-spirited, not good people. And I tried to tell myself, like, maybe they're just having an off day, but it happened enough times where I realized, like, you know, man, if I'm as a fan going to meet someone and they look me in the eye and shake my hand and treat me like a human being, that made me feel like I was on top of the world. Like, I met Ozzy Osbourne and he treated me like a human being. He didn't have to. He didn't owe me anything. Then I met other artists, which I won't name, that just looked down their nose at me like they were far superior human beings. And it really helped me realize that, like, you know, people that spend their money and their time and their effort to come see a show, whether they're headlining or we're opening up, if they spend their money on a t-shirt or a ticket and they're sitting there watching us, you know, paying attention, they don't owe me anything. So the fact that they took their time and efforts to dive into something that I'm putting out there, I owe them everything. So I spent 95% of my career in the crowd, with the crowd, watching all the other bands, interacting, just being a fan first. And, you know, I'm very fortunate that I got to be on the stage and off the stage, but I've made so many acquaintances and friendships over the last two decades just by being approachable and realizing, like, none of us are bigger than the music. None of us are bigger than the moment, you know, and each show we do could be someone's first experience with us. So it doesn't matter if we played the show of our lives last night. Tonight's a whole new crowd, a whole new experience, and we have to try to replicate that night in and night out and provide these people with the best entertainment we possibly can, because you never know what someone's going through and what the show or the songs or the lyrics might mean to them. So, you know, it's just all about being humble and being approachable and being appreciative for the moments that we're given.
That's beautifully inspiring, man. Very nice.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Paul McCoy from 12 Stones. That was awesome, dude. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. It was super inspiring. I can't wait for people to hear this. I'll put all your show notes in my show notes, And just, you know, keep pushing, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time today. And I had a blast. We'll have to do it again.
Definitely. Peace out, man.
Yes, indeed.
Sweet. There we have it. Paul McCoy, everybody. I'd like to publicly say thank you to Paul. Make sure you check him out. Make sure you check out 12 Stones. My name is Travis Mark. Make sure you check me and the Musician's Mentor website out at travismark.com or musicians-mentor.com. But mainly, and I know I go on about this, but please leave us a rating or review. We've got some really cool interviews coming up. I want to keep these things going for you. I'm enjoying doing them. I hope that you guys are getting something from this. Until next time, peace.